Welcome to a weekly markets update from Chief Investment Officer Sonia Loud and her team here at Legal & General Investment Management. This episode was recorded earlier today and is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to our weekly CIO market update, which we're holding for our clients during this period of volatility brought on by the coronavirus outbreak. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Bill Hughes, Head of Real Assets, Tim Dougal, Head of Investment Advisory, and Guy Whitby-Smith, Head of Solutions Portfolio Management. Now, even though we've just started a new quarter, the challenging and extraordinary past few weeks are still very fresh in our minds. So, Sonia, I'm going to kick off by asking you, how are the four pandemic-related variables that we discussed last week developing?
Thank you very much, Max, and good morning, everyone. As always, I hope this call sees you safe and healthy at your homes, and I'm delighted to share with you a few thoughts on what has actually changed compared to last week. So we will share with you the presentation that we sent to you last week after our call, and you will see what the changes we have implemented, and you can see the kind of changes we're tracking. So if I start with the markets update, then as we've highlighted last week, clearly March has had enough action in a quarter to fill the whole year. And it's clear by now that March has been the worst on record, not only for equity markets, but across a large number of the fixed income segments as well. Likewise, the snapback that we have seen in equity markets is, again, record-breaking, and you have to go back to the 1930s to find a similar strong snapback in markets. But this is not all that has happened. Clearly, we have seen the action that central banks have put in place, and as we have highlighted in our call last week, we believe actually that this is quite a constructive backdrop for fixed income markets, and hence we have seen actually quite a lot of new issuance from companies on the back of this. But likewise, as Colin really highlighted quite nicely last week, we obviously assume that the economic impact on fixed income very clearly will manifest itself in a number of rating actions and downgrades, and clearly this has started in fullness last week. Secondly, moving on to the actual development within COVID-19, I think the US clearly dominated headlines last week, and we actually have added a slide here that actually is looking at fatalities versus new infection rates, because we believe that fatalities will give us a clearer picture given the very strong difference in testing and testing numbers across countries. And you will see later when you get the presentation that obviously the US has seen an alarming jump in fatalities, and obviously the pictures we're getting from New York are not very reassuring. So this is very much on our minds, and with that, moving on to the economy, it's very clear that we are potentially entering the most intense phase of the contraction, and our economics team believes that we will see output levels down by roughly 20% at the beginning of April. This has been reflected in global PMIs yesterday, and we have been seeing global PMIs drop below 50 to 48.2. That is interestingly an increase over the February number, because the China numbers have seen an improvement. But to put this in perspective, obviously excluding China, we are now at 46.7, so in clear contraction territory. And this is even worse when you look at the new orders component, which is probably the most cyclical of the PMI components, which is now down to 41.1. So there's a clear contraction visible here. And we are now expecting labor market data to reflect the depth of the contraction as well. Again, the US has been at the forefront of negative news, because here we are getting weekly jobless claim numbers. And clearly we have seen a multiple increase in those weekly numbers. The latest is well above 4 million of new jobless claims. So with that in mind, you know that we have these three scenarios around the economic impact in mind, and it's very clear that so far we are still watching very carefully to see the new cases and the fatality numbers to slow down. So it's the second derivative that we are looking for, because that would give us an indication when countries can start lifting those restrictions, and only then can we start assessing how big the economic impact will be. Because it's clear, if countries remain in complete lockdown, then we do have a very clear understanding of how bad the impact is going to be. But the real focus will be on how quickly economies can recover without risking a second surge in new infections. And again, we're watching China very carefully, because that is clearly the first country that will start to lift those restrictions and actually has seen economic activity to actually move back up to levels of around 80-90% of their normal output.
To remind our listeners, those three scenarios, essentially, it's a V-shaped recovery, a U-shaped recovery, and an L-shaped economic recovery.
Yeah, close. The second one actually is a W, because the risk of the second surge would imply, if that is not manageable, we would see countries move back full into lockdown. And that obviously would imply that the economy would yet again come to a complete standstill. And those scenarios, again, you will find in that presentation back later. But it is clearly related to the difference in those scenarios is related to the way countries can emerge from the full lockdown while managing new infections. And depending on how successful countries and governments will be, the smoother the transition out of complete lockdown. But thanks for reminding me, Max, that obviously it's very clear, because I'm looking at the slide right now, whereas you listeners are not. Apologies for that. It's very clear as well that now we have stimulus packages in place. And I think the latest that we have added now to our overview slide, which we had alluded to during our call last week, is the package from the US, which by now is the largest globally and is equivalent to 8% of GDP. So this is an enormous amount of money that the US government has made available to various causes. As we discussed last week, we are still looking and watching very carefully how efficient they will be in actually making money available to those most in need, because it is clear that we need to support individuals rather than companies, and that is obviously a very different transmission mechanism than just giving more credit or liquidity to companies. So with that in mind, you can see that we are very carefully watching the US that clearly has moved to the epicenter of the global COVID-19 crisis. And it's very clear that obviously the total numbers that we will hear out of the US and that we will be witnessing will be much higher than what we are seeing or what we have been seeing so far in other countries. But with that in mind, it's very clear that we are moving towards a clearer picture on when restrictions might be lifted. And so all eyes will be on the success of governments to lift those restrictions, because then we will be able to assess the real impact on markets and asset classes. As we've highlighted during our call this week, due to the massive support framework that central banks have put in place, there's a slightly uneven picture on how we see long-term credit versus the equity markets, because it's very clear that we just see the beginning of major earnings downgrade cycles. There's lots of news about dividend suspension and dividend cuts. We've heard Germany and France telling companies that will receive state aid to please suspend dividends to preserve the cash. So there's huge impacts and huge changes that are currently impacting equity markets. And I think we had another reminder yesterday that volatility will be here to stay. With that, I'm very happy to hand back to Max so that you then now get an overview of our real asset segment and obviously our LDI book of business.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Sonia, for that fascinating overview of the current market dynamics. Yes, so staying with that theme of markets, let's go to Bill. Bill, what's going on in real estate and private credit markets right now?
Morning, Max, and good morning, everybody. We are in properly unprecedented times. And just to clarify, my comments are based predominantly on assets held in the UK. So on the real estate side, With the suspension of non-essential activities that we've seen, what that has caused immediately for physically consumer-facing assets, pretty much the total loss of revenue associated with those assets. So income to the businesses there has fallen off a cliff. Alongside that, we had in the UK a government announcement with regard to a moratorium on forfeiture of property for non-payment of rent. And whilst it wasn't entirely the intention of government, what's happened there is that tenants have interpreted that as legitimising non-payment of rent. So what we unfortunately have is a whole swathe of assets, principally retail, leisure, hospitality, where income is not being produced in the form of rent in the way it was. You may have seen Intu, as an owner of shopping centres, unfortunately only managed to collect 29% of its rent this year, compared to just under 80% a year ago. So that's the situation that's there. The way we're handling this is, if you think about how we're best positioned to preserve medium-term income from these assets, we've entered into a dialogue with these tenants around the deferral of rent. We've got over 600 conversations going on around that subject. So whilst we're keen to collect rent where we can, it's really important that we have a mature dialogue around the deferral program that may well help some of these businesses survive to the other side. And right now we've collected just under 2/3 of the income from our portfolio, which compares pretty favourably compared to those that are just orientated towards retail. Alongside that, we've had the valuation community in the UK bring in what they call material uncertainty clauses. And what's that about? That's because they see very little evidence of transactions upon which they depend, and they see uncertainty, so they don't feel sufficiently confident in their valuations to provide a view of value without caveat. And what has happened there is that has caused UK open-ended funds almost universally to suspend. That is to say, investors are not coming into those funds or indeed going out of those funds. And at the end of March, the valuers caveated, but the valuers came up with a view of the fact that on average market values have fallen by up to around 5%. So that's the real estate world. On the private credit side of things, some similar issues here, really. This is about cash flow to those that have provided debt to borrowers. And in fact, the regulators have provided some reasonably helpful guidance here, where they encourage lenders to consider waiving covenant breaches under COVID-19 related circumstances. So conceptually, it's the same sort of idea, which is it's really in our best interest, where possible, to provide some forbearance to allow borrowers or those that owe income to survive and get to the other side. And that's, in most cases, the right course of action to preserve medium-term income. So in that book of assets, we have a lot of dialogue going on with the borrowers about what we can do to help them get to the other side. So that's the big picture, Max. Very uncertain times for sure. And really what we're trying to do is preserve medium-term income and also assist the UK economy in getting safely to the other side of this rather unexpected outcome.
Well, thank you for that update, Bill. Very interesting, particularly in how you talk about providing support to viable but financially troubled businesses. Moving on to Tim. Tim, what's the recent regulatory guidance to defined benefit pension schemes regarding contributions? And why does this matter?
Morning, Max. Morning, everyone. Yes, that's right. So the pensions regulator came up with some guidance last Friday. They've highlighted that trustees should be open to reducing or deferring deficit contributions, given the uncertainty and the tough times for corporates, as long as dividends are also suspended. So they've said this could be up to 3 months if the trustees aren't able to have a full picture of the sponsor covenant, but it could potentially be longer as long as trustees are considering the sponsor covenant in more detail. So that's something I imagine a lot of trustees will already be considering if they've had requests from sponsors. And I think the key thing there is to, you know, just do take a look at the sponsor covenant, make sure there isn't value leakage from the company away from the pension scheme through dividend payments or through other creditors taking increased security on company assets.
Right. And just looking at it in a slightly more big picture view, I know you and the solutions team more broadly have been working on a framework of principles for portfolio construction. How does the market turbulence that's been brought on by the coronavirus outbreak fit within that framework? How do you judge it?
Yeah, that's right, Max. So we've sort of got an 8-point plan to how we think about building portfolios, and it serves as a pretty helpful checklist at the moment for trustees, I think. So the 8 points are: 1, investment beliefs and governance; 2, objectives; 3, investment opportunities; 4, diversification; 5, protection against unrewarded risks; 6, management of liquidity; 7, mitigation of tail risks; and 8, the ability to adapt to market conditions. So, you know, you can think through those points, but there's a few things, again, that the pensions regulator has highlighted in their guidance last week. So some key points being the governance point. So at the moment, obviously, it's quite tricky for trustee boards to meet. So is the investment governance working? How are decisions being made? Do you have a full committee? Is there a subcommittee? You know, there are things that can be done there. So taking time to review that and making sure that you are able to react quickly in these turbulent times is important. On the objective side, the looking at strategy at the moment is going to be important. We've seen some big falls in funding levels and potentially lower contributions. So that will mean that some more detailed reviews of investment strategy are probably likely to be needed. On the investment opportunities point, what we've heard about credit actually is potentially now a good opportunity for particularly for schemes who are maybe are better funded. Maybe putting that into a mandate and locking in the better yields could be a good opportunity. One key one that the pensions regulator highlighted has been liquidity management. So there's a few challenging points here really, which is that we're seeing lower market liquidity, so being a suspension of property or higher dealing spreads in assets like credit. So that's going to make it more difficult for schemes to sell assets potentially if they need to. Add that to potentially lower contributions coming in, lower asset income from dividends, and potentially increased outflows if you see members trying to transfer out because they need cash. So that could be a bit of a cash flow challenge for pension schemes. So they might want to consider holding a bit more cash in their portfolios, or at least considering how pensions are going to be paid. So those are probably a few points I'd highlight for trustees to be thinking about.
Right. Thanks, Tim. Lots of food for thought there. Let's stay with the theme of credit markets and move to Guy. Guy, what's happened to credit spreads recently, and where do you see opportunities, potential opportunities in those markets?
Thanks, Max, and good morning. Yeah, we're certainly getting asked these questions a lot by clients at the moment. As with most financial markets, the credit market has been massively impacted by recent events. The combination of significant declines in sentiment and liquidity has led credit spreads to widen dramatically across the globe. A contributing factor to this has been the large moves in both interest rates and FX, which has meant some investors needed to sell bonds to raise cash in order to fund outflows and margin payments. However, things have changed dramatically in the last few weeks, as the promise of unlimited liquidity has had a material impact on investor sentiment, particularly at shorter maturities. And in the past week or so, selling of credit has now been replaced with buying of credit, albeit on a highly discriminative basis. That said, credit spreads remain very elevated. Currently, sterling investment-grade corporate bonds yield around 2.6% above the equivalent gilts. And put that in context, that's more than double the spread that we were seeing on credit bonds just a few weeks ago. Spreads are now at levels that would more than compensate investors, even if defaults rose to the level that we experienced during the 2008-2009 financial crisis. And we believe credit spreads are now more likely to move tighter in the near term, given the size and breadth of the fiscal stimulus and central bank quantitative easing programs being unleashed that we discussed more detail on last week's call. This has led us to be more positive on investment-grade credit, and in our view, it is now an attractive time to increase allocations to credit. And indeed, we're seeing a number of clients looking to implement this, in particular, increasing allocations to buy and maintain credit. I mean, one practical point I just wanted to highlight is that during this period of significant market volatility, we've seen an increase in collateral margin requirements, in particular for hedges on US dollar credit bonds. This has demonstrated why it can be beneficial for clients to have these portfolios managed alongside LDI mandates, both for risk and liquidity purposes. For these clients, we've avoided being a forced seller of credit at times of acute market stress, and instead simply sourced any cash or collateral needs from the LDI portfolio.
Thanks, Guy. Very interesting. And just staying with LDI, I mean, more broadly, how can schemes adjust their LDI strategies given this very uncertain outlook?
Yeah, in terms of adjusting LDI strategies, I guess the three main points that I'd look to make here. I guess, firstly, is to try to be as opportunistic as possible. Ensure your mandate has the flexibility to allow us to take advantage of opportunities if and when they arise. I mean, a good example of this was last month in mid-March. I mean, we saw gilt yields sort of surge upwards, but that really only lasted for a few days before sort of the quantitative easing from the Bank of England brought yields back down. And really, the only schemes we were able to really take advantage of those that already had enough flexibility in their mandate for us to be able to act quickly. And in a number of cases, we were able to do that. And the last couple of points I'd make are, I guess, a heightened awareness of counterparty risk in the current environment. Clearly, there's sort of pressures on corporates and banks, and that will feed through to banks as well. I mean, in terms of managing counterparty risk, I mean, obviously, diversification is key to that, but I guess the other one we'd look to is a sort of central clearing where possible, so avoiding sort of direct exposure to banks. And I guess the last thing to highlight is liquidity or lack of it in the markets generally. I mean, it's definitely been an incredibly challenging month of March from a liquidity perspective. I mean, even more so than what we saw in 2008, 2009. Again, trying to be able to be as nimble as possible, we've done a lot of trying to match up sort of internal client flows to sort of minimize the amount of risk that we've been putting through the market. And again, in terms of swaps, central clearing again has been very advantageous there, as we've seen cleared swaps being much less impacted and more resilient in face of liquidity challenges than sort of bilateral trades with banks.
Thank you, Guy. Let's move back to Sonia now to look at something we think a lot about as a business, and that's ESG. So, Sonia, how might the coronavirus outbreak affect the way that asset managers approach responsible investing?
That clearly shouldn't impact any ESG-related strategy. And I actually found a very interesting snippet earlier around the performance of higher rated ESG companies. And it turns out that in the US, since the S&P 500's peak, top ranked ESG stocks outperformed the wider market by over 5 percentage points. So that is very interesting. So it is clear that it seems that the financial materiality that we have highlighted as one of our core kind of features, that, and this is indeed true, and that companies that have a better proposition overall, including ESG related factors, have fared better so far. I will caveat this because it is a short time period to look at, but it will definitely not change any of our strategy or indeed the way funds are managed. And I think it more or less reinforces what we have been saying, and looking at these numbers, obviously, it seems that we were right in that.
Thank you. And moving over to Bill to ask a really kind of long-term question. Once we come out of this crisis on the other side, if it's possible to look that far ahead, what long-term changes do you envisage to the ways we live and work, particularly within the built environment?
Yeah, Max, it's a really tough question, but we are thinking about that. I think there's really two scenarios that I'm thinking about right now. One is if we get to the world post-coronavirus and there's a reversion totally back to normal, then I would envisage that people will really cherish the human experience of being in offices with colleagues and in a retail leisure environment where they get social interaction with other people. So it's possible that this abstinence turns into some excitement about the recovery and the return to normal circumstances. But I can't help thinking that things have changed forever to some extent. So the fact that we've all been forced to work remotely and understand what that feels like and how that works, and for companies to operate really out of our own homes, does have long-term consequences for what is an office and the extent to which people will want to pay rent. So I think there'll be a more discerning approach to procurement and provision of offices and the tenants that are in them. And I think in terms of retail, similar sort of story, really. We've all been forced to shop online over several years, but I think the dependence upon internet retailing has clearly grown in recent weeks. And I think, again, that will make it really important for ongoing retail provision to think really hard about what quality of experience is it providing, and is it going to attract individuals to be there in the world post-COVID, or is the home delivery that we're all getting more used to, is that itself relatively appealing? And so retail will have to fight for its existence, and offices will have to be better provided so that they provide enduring attraction, in my view.
Right, well, let's end up on that really thought-provoking, interesting point. I certainly very much look forward to that human experience of being back in the office you just mentioned. Right, I'd like to thank Sonia, Bill, Tim and Guy. Thank you all for your time today. And I'd like to thank our clients for dialing in. If you have any questions that you'd like to put to the panel next week, please let your usual LGIM representative know.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.